Chapter 9. Paradise. Invoking their non-existent rights as POWs made the questioning take an unpleasant turn from the previously friendly conversation with the Burgermeister. Two Ruhar soldiers, one male and one female, came into the room and Baterna Logelia left, although she told the new Ruhar that the two humans didn't know anything. 4 hours later, the two Ruhar intelligence officers agreed. Dave Chaika and Jesse Coulter had no useful information about Joe Bishop or his companions after Joe had been arrested. Sophisticated Ruhar medical scanning gear in the room indicated the two humans had been genuinely surprised to hear that their friend had survived the Ruhar strike on the jail he had been held in. The Ruhar intel officers were not pleased, and they told the two humans that. Just in case the humans were holding back information, they would be detained until further notice. To make matters worse, the only human food at their airbase was yummy, nutrient mush. It was not at all yummy. Dave and Jesse were marched across the base to another building, where they were put into a room with two human women. The room was a sort of barracks. It had 6 rows of bunk beds and a bathroom in the corner. One of the women was a U.S. Army major. Jesse and Dave saluted when they saw her. The other woman had her back to them. She was folding blankets. "Major," he read her name tag. "Perkins," Dave began to say. Then the other woman turned around and he recognized her with a shock. "Shauna?" Jesse was equally surprised. "Shauna? Shauna Jarrett?" He was guessing to remember her last name. Jesse hadn't seen her since Camp Alpha, and he hadn't known her well then. Shauna looked very much the same as she did way back on Camp Alpha. Her skin was more tanned, and her hair a bit shorter. And she'd lost weight, like they all had on UNEF's restricted diet since the Ruhar took the planet back. As Jesse remembered, Shauna didn't have much weight to lose.
"I'm Shauna, and you are..."
"Wait, you're Joe Bishop's friends." She clapped her hands together in front of her mouth.
"One of you is Cornpone."
She made a guess based on his southern accent and pointed to Jesse.
"Jesse Coulter, ma'am,"
Jesse said graciously, his voice slightly unsteady. He was out of practice talking with women. On impulse, he stuck out his hand, and she shook it. He hoped his hand wasn't shaking too much.
"And you must be Ski. I know you're not Sergeant Coke."
"Dave Chaika," he said, and shook her hand.
"We haven't seen the sergeant in a while. Jesse and I have been on an ag team, and Sergeant Coke signed up for security duty."
Coke had told them he had enough of farming while growing up in Georgia. The other woman, the major, cleared her throat.
"Sorry, Major Perkins, we haven't seen Shauna since Camp Alpha."
"I gathered that," Perkins said dryly.
"Jesse Coulter." She remembered something from Bishop's file.
"People call you Cornpone."
"Bishop called me Cornpone," Jesse shook his head. "Before I met him, my nickname was Shooter, mostly."
Perkins looked at him sideways. "Why, are you trigger happy?"
"No," Jesse explained.
"When I played basketball in high school, some people thought I took a lot of shots on the basket, like too many, you know?"
"Did you?"
"Seeing as the other guys on the team couldn't hit the side of a barn, there wasn't much point in me passing the ball, ma'am." Perkins nodded, satisfied.
"Coulter, Chaika, you two have been questioned. They're bringing in everyone who served with Bishop or knew him."
She almost said intimately, then decided Shauna might object to that.
"Knew him well."
"They questioned us, yes, ma'am," Jesse confirmed. "We didn't tell them anything."
"We don't know anything," Dave added.
"Is it true, Major? Joe is alive?"
Perkins bit her lip.
"I do not know. I served in intel at UNEF HQ. We certainly thought he was dead. There were rumors that he had been flying around in a Ruhar dropship, but there were a lot of crazy rumors going around back then. The Ruhar did take everyone from a logistics base. They've been isolated since the Ruhar took the planet back. We have requested contact with them, and the Ruhar have refused. Until now, I didn't know why. My assessment is," she said, speaking like an intelligence officer, "that whether it is true or not, the Ruhar definitely believe that Joe is alive. Joe and 3 companions. Did they tell you anything about these 3 companions?
"No, ma'am," Dave replied.
"We know who was at the Kristang jail when the Ruhar hit it, so the list is limited," Major Perkins mused. "Be careful what you say here. I expect this room is bugged, although I do not think any of us know anything useful. I was as shocked as you to hear that Bishop is alive."
"If he is alive,"
Jesse clenched his fists.
That SOB should have let us know.
He looked at Shauna. He should have told someone.
After a bland and quick dinner of nutrient mush, the four semi-prisoners were glumly sitting around their barracks, or cell, or whatever the Ruhar wanted to call it.
Jesse, Shauna started. Then, Dave, you two are with Joe in Nigeria.
What happened with him in Nigeria?
Shauna asked with a look toward Major Perkins.
It's not classified, Perkins said with a shrug. I'd like to hear about it myself. Bishop's personnel record had a lot of gaps in it.
A lot happened, Dave said with a frown.
None of it good, Jesse added.
That's because the army doesn't give medals for stupid, Dave said with a smile. They try to train the stupid out of you. It didn't work all the way with Joe.
You got that right, Jesse grinned.
You're asking about the rumor that Joe was up for a Bronze Star?
Yes.
Shauna leaned forward on the bunk.
I asked him about it and he wouldn't tell me. He said it was a mistake.
Jesse snorted.
The whole thing was a mistake. We weren't supposed to be there. It wasn't strictly forbidden, we just weren't.
Look, don't ask, okay?
We shouldn't have been in the damn country in the first place, Dave said. They sent us over there without having any clue what our mission...
Dave, Jesse said gently.
We were there. All four of us. We know.
Sorry. Go on with the story.
So we're in this village. There's a girls' school with...
I better not tell you that part.
Jesse looked at the floor.
There was a girls' school. By the time we got there with Joe, it was a burned-out shell. We were there because...
Don't tell them that part, Dave said quickly.
It's not classified, Jesse replied.
Yeah, but it's embarrassing, and he's not here.
Joe isn't the he I'm talking about, he explained to Perkins and Shauna.
Fine, Jesse agreed. I'll skip to the part where Joe did something stupid.
We were behind an overturned truck. There was another squad working around a building, and we were providing covering fire. An RPG hit the road near us and exposed an IED right next to us. A big one. This one was built to take out a tank or a Bradley.
Joe jumps on it. He's like, go, run, save yourselves, Dave laughed.
Right then I knew Joe is a total idiot. With an IED that size, if it had blown up, we would have been more in danger from flying Bishop parts than from the explosive.
Jesse broke up laughing about the incident. It had not been funny in the least at the time.
We're yelling at him to come with us, and while we're yelling, we're not far enough away if it goes off. Finally, Sergeant Koch orders Joe to get the hell off the thing and run with us. He jumps up. I was surprised he hadn't pissed his pants. I guess he's not smart enough to be scared.
Did it explode? Shauna asked, her eyes wide.
Nah, they screwed up the wiring or something, Jesse said, shaking his head. Or it was a dud. I think it was an old Soviet mine. We saw the guy who was trying to detonate it. He was in a window at first, and he's kind of hanging out the window trying to get the remote to work. He forgot the batteries or something, or the detonator failed. Anyway, the stupid SOB is hanging out the window shouting at the IED when Sergeant Koch drills him right in the head. 2 shots, bang, bang.
Jesse mimicked the dead insurgent falling backward.
It was a great shot.
He caught Dave's eyes.
I guess you don't need to hear about that.
Joe jumped on an IED, Shauna asked.
To save you?
Joe jumped on that IED because he was stupid, Dave clarified. That's why he didn't get a medal for it. If that thing had gone off, him laying on top of it wouldn't have made any difference. The army expected him to know that.
That's Joe, Jesse concluded. Not real smart. I still don't know if he's brave or just too dumb to know any better.
With another gamma ray burst over Lemuria, a Kristang frigate emerged. This time it was not the familiar to see glory and battle as glorious, but her brother ship. Every day is a good day to die in battle. The Glory's reactor was offline for a maintenance cycle, so her brother ship had been given the honor of jumping in. The Good Day planned on burning human croplands for several minutes, possibly tangling with a Ruhar frigate, and then jumping away. The Good Day's crew had eagerly been looking forward to the raid, having grown sick of their comrades on the Glory strutting around like they had been winning the war against the Ruhar all by themselves. Good Day's captain was determined to outdo his colleague. He intended to remain behind and engage in combat as much as his little ship could take before jumping away.
He got his first wish. He did not get the second. Unknown to the Kristang, despite their long-range surveillance and the stealth sensor satellites they had dropped off on every raid, there was a stealth Ruhar destroyer above Lemuria. The Commodore of the Ruhar Defense Force was still under pressure from the Planetary Administrator to do something to protect the humans, despite the severe damage to the frigate Tolan Grathur. So the destroyer City of McMurrow had gone into maximum stealth and drifted into position on minimum power, taking 2 full days to reach a spot high above Lemuria. She had arrived 1 day too late to save the Tolan Grathur, for the original plan was for that unstealth frigate to act as bait for the hidden destroyer. The Ruhar Commodore neglected to inform the Kristang of his plan, and the aggressive Kristang had acted too soon. Without another ship to act as bait, the McMurrow still waited patiently, her crew on alert, her weapons ready. Surely the previous Kristang raid would not be the last one, and the McMurrow would get revenge for the 4 dead Ruhar aboard the Grathur. To maintain maximum stealth, her sensor field was off, but ready to activate at any moment. A sensor field was not required to detect the signature gamma-ray burst of a starship jumping in, and the McMurrow saw the good day immediately. Even before the destroyer's sensor field had extended, maser beams and railgun darts were on the way toward the Kristang frigate with a volley of missiles close behind. By sheer bad luck, the good day had jumped in less than 12,000 kilometers from the hidden destroyer, presenting an exceptionally easy target. Every day is a good day to die in battle, lived up to her name by dying in battle that day. With her shields degraded by the strain of deflecting almost point-blank maser cannon fire, she took a direct hit from a railgun dart that penetrated completely through the frigate, plunged into the atmosphere of paradise, and created a tremendous splash in the ocean. The impact of the railgun dart temporarily knocked out power and communications to the ship's jump drive, so the good day was a sitting duck for crucial seconds. Seconds the McMurrow did not waste. That destroyer poured everything she had into the Kristang frigate, and the third missile fired by the McMurrow scored a direct hit. The good day exploded, violently enough that the McMurrow had to jump away to avoid being struck by high-energy debris. Hours later, the McMurrow jumped back into position, engaged its stealth field, and with minimum power from thrusters, began slowly to drift back toward the northern continent. The Ruhar Commodore was satisfied he had done what he could to protect the human POWs from assaults by their own patrons. Certainly he had done more than he had wanted to. The Kristang certainly had detected the McMurrow jumping back into position, and hopefully the lizards would assume the destroyer was still there above the southern continent, lying in wait for another raider. The Kristang would either cease their raids on the human croplands, or include more and heavier ships on raids. If the Kristang used more ships, that would provide the Commodore with additional information about his enemy, and he would act accordingly. Until then, the McMurrow would rejoin the task force protecting the vital facilities and population of the northern continent, and the humans would have to hope that the Kristang would now see burning their crops as too great a risk to their limited number of ships. Flying Dutchman.
You were right, Joe. This was a great idea. Oh, shut up, I groaned.
Yep, one of your bestest ideas ever, Joey.
Hey, this reminds me of the last time it was just you and me in a dropship floating in space for a long, long, really long will-this-ever-end, oh my God, if he doesn't shut up, I'm going to kill him length of time.
Thank you, Skippy, I heard you the first time, and the 100 other times you said the exact same freaking thing.
I'm just saying, I know. This is like getting the band back together, except that you can't sing, or play a musical instrument, or write songs, Skippy.
Yes?
I'm mortal, I reminded our friendly alien AI. I can leave my helmet off, force the airlock doors open, and embrace the sweet, sweet release of death. You, on the other hand, would be stuck right here in interstellar space until the end of time.
Hey, with the door open, it wouldn't smell like fermented monkey butt in here, so go for it.
Leaning forward, I banged my forehead on the dropship's pilot console.
Worst idea ever, I mumbled.
When did you realize that, Joe?
Let me think. It was 17 days ago.
We've only been here 17 days, Joe.
Exactly.
Me in a dropship with only 2 companions, Skippy and a tactical nuclear warhead. Between the two, I was beginning to prefer the company of Nuki, as I called it. According to the United States Air Force, Nuki had a variable yield of between 3 and 20 kilotons. Figuring that if I was going to nuke something, I might as well go big,
I had cranked up the dial to 20.
Nuki didn't say much. It just sat there, strapped in behind the co-pilot seat, emitting neutrons every once in a while. Nuki was the strong, silent type. Skippy, on the other hand, could not shut up. We had run out of things to talk about after the first, hour, but that hadn't stopped him. He had cheerily driven me crazy for 17 days, and he had an unending supply of nothing to talk about. As one example, I was now well-educated about how 17th-century Hungarian poetry was influenced by the... Ah, damn it. I hadn't been paying enough attention when Skippy told me the first two or three times, so, tragically, I had no idea what had influenced the Hungarian poets of the 17th century. Some kind of alcohol, I expect. And given that they were poets, hunger and poverty were likely in the mix also. By day three, I had been praying, please, please, God, do not allow Skippy to give me a pop quiz on any of the boring trivia he had told me. If I failed a quiz, which I would, Skippy would simply start at the beginning and repeat everything. That incredibly annoying little beer can was sitting securely strapped into the co-pilot seat. Aboard the Flying Dutchman, he spent all his time in an escape pod, so I only saw him once or twice a day when I stopped by to visit. Skippy always told me that physical proximity was meaningless and unnecessary, but I think he appreciated that I took the time to sit with him. Now I had seen him constantly for 17 days, and it reminded me how small, alone, and in many ways helpless our friendly ancient alien AI was. He looked cute sitting there, glowing a soft blue when he was happy, red when he was angry, or any combination of colors that he did for my benefit. Skippy looked especially cute because he was wearing a tiny Red Sox home jersey and baseball cap that day. Before we left the ship, Major Sims had handed me a box with instructions not to open it until the dropship was on station near the wormhole. It was a box containing dozens of tiny outfits for Skippy. I do not know where Sims got the idea, but she totally made my day when I opened that box. Day after boring day waiting in the dropship, there were only three things I had to look forward to. Sleeping that night when Skippy finally shut up, doing zero-G exercises as best I could using rubber bands, and dressing Skippy in a new outfit around mid-morning each day. All right, Skippy, it's time to change your clothes, I decided. It was only 08:35, but there wasn't anything else to do. Besides, while I was eating breakfast that morning, Skippy had threatened to spend most of the day educating me on the structural, spiritual, and functional differences between pyramids in Egypt and those in Mesoamerica. All I knew was the pyramids in what is now Mexico are bigger. If he was going to bore me, I would strike first by humiliating him. Let's see, I said, looking in the box. How about a cowboy get-up today? No. Look at this, Skippy, I said, holding up the pieces of clothing. There's this shirt with a leather vest, and even a gold star. I guess this is for a sheriff or deputy. Ha-ha, and a tiny black curly mustache. I picked up the mustache and applied it to Skippy between his baseball jersey and hat. No, get that ridiculous mustache off me right now. Major Sims is totally on my Skippy hates this list.
Oh, and a cute little Stetson hat for you, cowpoke.
No. Oh, I swear, if you put that silly cowboy hat on my lid, I'm going to light off that nuke right now. Heads up, Joe. A ship jumped in. Oh, thank God. My thoughts exactly. And don't jinx it this time, you big stupid head. All I said was that I hoped the last ship was the right one, I protested. Yes, and the universe heard you, and because the universe hates you, it was the wrong ship. Again, I'm the one who suffers being stuck in this cramped dropship with you day after day. You. Hell, I have to listen to your boring trivia, and I have to agonize over how to explain the simplest of concepts to... Skippy? What? The alien ship? Oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot. What were we... Oh, that's right.
Looking good, Joe. It is looking good. This could be the one.
After 17 days stuck in close quarters with Skippy, if the ship that had just jumped in was not a good candidate, I was ready to give up and go back to the Dutchman for a break. Or set off the nuke just for entertainment. Either way would be fine with me. Damn, that little beer can could be annoying. Skippy had originally calculated that in order to have a 50% chance of contacting the right Thoranan ship, we would have to park our little dropship near a wormhole entrance for 68 days. When he told me that, I was ready to appeal the decision to the statistics referees of the universe. The idea of being stuck in a dropship for one single freaking day with just Skippy and Nuki for company was bad enough. After 17 days, during which we had encountered Thoranan ships three times, and none of them had been the type of ship we were looking for, I was ready to kill him.
or myself, hopefully both. No way was I getting my hopes up until Skippy was 100% sure this ship was the one we had been seeking.
Could be. Verifying now, he said with a flat, emotionless tone that indicated he was concentrating on something.
We had several criteria for a candidate ship. It had to be a Thoranan warship. Support or civilian ships would likely not have access to the classified fleet deployment and relay station crew rotation schedules that we needed. The ship needed to be going through the wormhole that our dropship was parked near, and the ship had to be planning to contact one of the three data relay stations in the area. Oh, and incidentally, the ideal ship would be alone, or at least not part of a full battle group.
Good to go, Joe. We are good to go. These ships are perfect.
These ships? I see a heavy cruiser and two destroyers, I said fearfully. A squadron of Thoranan destroyers had ambushed and very nearly vaporized our pirate star carrier. This time there was a heavy cruiser with the two destroyers.
Skippy made a raspberry sound. Please, Joe, this is no problemo for us. The destroyers are flying combat space patrol for that cruiser. They are far enough away that there is no way they could detect us.
Are you sure about... Right then I saw the flaw in Sims's idea to dress Skippy in cute little outfits. It was hard for me to take him seriously while he was wearing a Red Sox jersey and hat, and a tiny mustache. It was good those ships jumped in before I had time to put the tiny cowboy outfit on him.
Are you sure about that?
Joe, I calculate the additional mission risk posed by those destroyers as 1/3 of 1%. Less than that, if you want me to get more detailed than meh-level math.
No, please don't. Please.
Well?
Well what?
Well, get moving, dum-dum. You're flying this thing. I shook myself back to focus and gently started the dropship toward the Thoranan heavy cruiser.
Heavy cruiser. Heavy like it had really big rail guns and maser cannons.
The particle cannons that ship used just to zap hazardous space debris out of its way could blast us into subatomic particles.
Damn, that ship was big.
With us in super stealth mode, I couldn't look out the cockpit window. All the photons headed toward our dropship were bent by the stealth field and curved right around the hull. I adjusted the cockpit display to show me the tiny bits of data that Skippy was allowing inside the stealth field, and I compared the size of the heavy cruiser to our dropship. The dropship wasn't even a dot on the display. Sure, our pirate star carrier was larger than a heavy cruiser, before Skippy shrunk our ship. But star carriers were immensely long and slender, while the cruiser was bulky. I had to remind myself that on long missions, star carriers transported an entire battle group of destroyers, cruisers, and even battleships. I also had to remind myself that star carriers were not combatant ships. The weapons, shields, and sensors aboard that heavy cruiser vastly outclassed those aboard our pirate ship. Skippy assured me that with him feeding bullshit data to the cruiser's sensors, all they would see inside our dropship were two little green Thoranan cyborgs. They would not see an ancient alien AI wearing a baseball uniform and a mustache. They would not see a low-yield nuclear weapon that had Adios MFers written on the side of it. Also, our nuke had a smiley face drawn on it, and a Hello Kitty sticker. Most importantly, they would not see a human. No matter. I had promised Chotek that if the Thoranan suspected our dropship wasn't being flown by Thoranan, I would set off the nuke without hesitation. After 17 days with Skippy, part of me was praying for us to be discovered. 17 minutes later, an ironic number, we got close enough to the heavy cruiser for Skippy to do his thing.
Busy, he said tersely.
I knew not to bother him. Lightly touching his shiny surface confirmed that he was slightly warm.
Oh shit, they detected us.
Damn it, I was like 80% done. Dropping the stealth field now. Dropping our stealth field close to a Thoranan heavy cruiser might not sound like a good idea, or a sane idea. It was actually part of my plan. The plan I had sold to Chotek and Chang and Sims and Smythe. And Skippy.
Are they buying your line of bullshit? I asked anxiously.
Hook, line, and sinker, Joe. It is working like a charm, which, you know, kills me to say that another of your monkey brain plans is working.
You'll get over it.
It wasn't easy to joke while my finger was poised over the detonator of a nuclear weapon. Chotek had approved my plan only on the condition that if the Thoranan even began to suspect there was something other than sugar in our sugar bowl, I would turn all the evidence into subatomic particles. Nuki could thoroughly destroy me and the dropship. Skippy would be fine, although he would lose his collection of cute little outfits.
Explosion of the nuke would send our friendly beer can unharmed but spinning off into space, and the Flying Dutchman could recover him later and start over with a different, better idea. Chang would need to wait a month or so to collect Skippy, as the area would most likely be crawling with Theranan ships investigating the incident. After the Dutchman jumped in, Skippy could ping them to pick him up. I was mostly hoping that using Nuki wouldn't be necessary.
And done. Done, Skijo. We are done a palooza. Mission accomplished. This part of the mission, anyway. I got all the data we need, and I planted a message for that cruiser to carry to a relay station. As a bonus, it happens to be the closest relay station. Great. Now we play along? Yes. Take the dropship 200,000 kilometers away, and we will re-engage stealth. I got the dropship turned around and fired the engines. What Skippy had done already was the first part of the plan. Get close to a Theranan warship, ransack its database, and plant a message. Now we needed to convince that ship's crew and AI that there was nothing sinister or unusual about our presence. No reason for the ship's AI to look carefully at its memory storage. No reason for that ship's AI to suspect someone had been poking around in its highly classified, encrypted files. And no reason to notice it now contained a message that wasn't there before. What I had realized in the Dutchman's galley, while staring at a sugar bowl that didn't contain sugar, was that it was okay if the Theranan detected our Theranan dropship. What was not okay is if they detected the Theranan dropship had a human inside it. So what we did was encase our dropship in an extra powerful stealth field, enhanced by the powers of Skippy, and we snuck up close to a Theranan heavy cruiser. Even with enhanced stealth, the cruiser eventually detected us and locked weapons on our location. At that point, as planned, Skippy had deactivated our stealth field to show the Theranan that the mysterious object sneaking up on their flank was a Theranan dropship. A Theranan dropship with all the proper high-level military authentication codes. A modified Theranan dropship, because we had attached a bunch of useless junk to the outside of the hull. The crew of the cruiser didn't know our modifications were all fake. Skippy had told them that our dropship contained a highly advanced experimental stealth unit, and the stuff attached to the outside of our dropship was part of the super stealth gear. That advanced technology was how we had been able to get so close to the cruiser before being detected. Skippy told the cruiser that we had been in the area for over a month, and the heavy cruiser was the first ship to detect us. Congratulations to the crew of the cruiser for their vigilance. Their exemplary performance would be noted by the Theranan Office of Special Projects. Of course, the entire incident was top secret, and the crew and AI of the cruiser were to forget everything they had seen. The Theranan bought the whole story. Feeding their cyborg egos had certainly helped. To finish selling our story, we backed off 200,000 kilometers, re-engaged stealth, and snuck up on the other side of the cruiser until they detected us again. Then we backed away, reactivated stealth, and flew in a wide circle around the cruiser, dropping stealth on the other side of the ship. That time Skippy lied to them. We got very close and they had not detected us. Skippy thanked the cruiser for assisting the Office of Special Projects to test our advanced stealth capability in a field environment. Then we went back into stealth and I got us the hell out of there. Less than 2 hours later, the heavy cruiser and its pair of escorts went through the wormhole and we were alone. I sent the retrieval signal to the Flying Dutchman, a signal that would take 4 hours to reach the ship. Looking around the interior of the dropship in dismay, I realized that some house cleaning was in order. You know what, Skippy? Maybe it does smell like fermented monkey butt in here. Duh, Joe. Hey, I've been washing up as best I can in that tiny sink. I will take another sponge bath, get into a fresh spacesuit, and open the door to vacuum for a couple minutes. The place did smell better after that. Certainly I smelled better. And when the Dutchman arrived to pick us up, Skippy was dressed up in a pirate costume, including an eye patch and a tiny parrot on top of his tiny hat. He hated it. Sergeant Adams assured him that he was adorable. He hated that even worse. Paradise. To Major Perkins' surprise, the formal questioning by the Ruhar lasted only another 2 days, off and on, then weeks went by when nothing happened. The four were allowed open communication with each other. Perkins guessed the Ruhar were hoping they would reveal information by mistake. Since none of them had information the Ruhar cared about, open communication was not a problem. They were not allowed to use Z-phones. Dave and Jesse worried that guys in Fort Rakovsky might be screwing with their hooch. He and Jesse had finished it, complete with a couch that now had a nice cover, a coffee table, and a dining table with four chairs.
No girls yet, but they were patient. Theirs was the nicest hooch in the bustling village of Fort Rakovsky. It had better, Dave swore, be in great condition when they returned. Whenever that was. With the questioning apparently over, the four humans were moved to another building outside the airbase. This building had two sleeping areas, so they did not have to hang blankets from the ceiling in order to give the women privacy. 3 weeks went by, with the four allowed to go outside for exercise and even to walk far afield without a Ruhar escort, as long as they returned before dark. If the humans tried to escape, the Ruhar could surely track them. Perkins suspected the Ruhar had planted tiny tracking devices in their clothing. So, if the humans wanted to escape, they would do it naked, into a wilderness that contained nothing humans could eat. That was not a tempting idea to any of them. There were even deliveries of real human food to supplement the nutrient mush they were all growing heartily sick of. Through their Ruhar guards, they learned that the Ruhar had also detained Sergeant Koch, plus the three members of Joe's embedded observation team on Paradise, and several people who had helped Joe shoot down the two Ruhar whales at Fort Arrow. They were being held in separate places. Major Perkins speculated that the Ruhar had picked up the humans wherever they were and simply flew them to the nearest Ruhar base. When they had been held for 5 weeks, Major Perkins raised the issue of their continued captivity with one of their guards, a female Ruhar named Mindu, who Perkins had been trying to develop a friendship with. Perkins could speak the common Ruhar language, not fluently yet to her chagrin, but passable. "We have been here for over a month," she used the Ruhar rough time equivalent for month. "We have not been questioned for many days. Why are we still being held? It must be clear that the four of us have no information about Joe Bishop. I assume you have technology that can tell when a human is not telling the truth."
"We have such technology, yes," Mindu replied slowly in Ruhar without using a translator. "Instruments which can detect when a subject is lying or withholding the full truth." "Then you know we do not have any useful information."
"No, we know that our instruments have not detected any falsehoods. However, our commanders are afraid to release you just yet, for they fear the consequences if it is later discovered that you concealed important information. They are, as you humans say, covering their asses."
Perkins smiled wryly. "That sentiment is universal among intelligent species."
"There is also the matter that this Joe Bishop escaped from this planet using technology that should not have been available to humans. Technology that even we do not possess. You will understand, hopefully, that we are rightly concerned that a species controlling such powerful technology might also be able to fool a lie detector."
"I see," Perkins frowned. How could they prove that humans did not have access to technology superior to the Ruhar? They did not possess any such technology. Although Bishop did, or so the Ruhar believed.
"There is another reason you are still here, M. Lee," Mindu said, being unable to pronounce the I in Emily. "There is a Jarraptha ship coming to this planet. The Jarraptha wish to question you. They are also concerned that humans had access to technology which allowed a dropship to fly right through the middle of our fleet without detection."
"Jarraptha?" Perkins asked with alarm. No human had ever seen or spoken with the patron species of the Ruhar. From the description provided by the Kristang, the Jarraptha were horrible, beetle-like insects who would love to feast on humans. The Ruhar had laughed at that clumsy bit of Kristang propaganda and insisted the Jarraptha were wonderful patrons. Although even the Ruhar admitted privately that they had an instinctive species revulsion toward insects.
"Do not worry, Emily. The Jarraptha will be gentle. You should be careful, though. They love to play practical jokes."
"Jokes?" Perkins exclaimed in surprise.
"Oh, yes. The Jarraptha love jokes. They laugh frequently. So much that some people make the mistake of underestimating their military potential. The Jarraptha are formidable warriors. They simply think there is no reason they can't have fun doing it. They also love gambling. Even gambling on combat operations."
She shook her head.
"They are strange little insects."
7 weeks after they were brought in for questioning, Major Perkins and her three soldiers were outside playing a two-on-two game of volleyball. UNEF had donated a recreation package at the request of the Ruhar. The four humans were growing stir-crazy with the boredom of inactivity. The previous 2 days had been solid rain, forcing the four to stay inside, except going out for a 5-mile run that had been Shauna Jarrett's idea. She had qualified for infantry duty and didn't want to lose her conditioning, even though UNEF currently had no openings for infantry. No openings for any jobs other than agriculture. Perkins and Chaika were playing against Jarrett and Coulter. Those two, Shauna and Jesse, had developed a friendship over the almost 2 months the four had been together. Maybe more than a friendship. There was certainly no UNEF or U.S. Army regulation against it. They were both specialists and not even in the same unit. Not that units had any real meaning anymore on Paradise. Perkins would have thought it odd if Shauna didn't like Jesse Coulter. He was attractive, and his southern charm smoothed out his rough edges. Shauna was also from the American South, so they had that in common. Major Perkins didn't care what relationship developed between Shauna and Jesse other than if their relationship affected Dave Chaika. She had seen him moping by himself while Shauna and Jesse played cards, and the relationship between the two men was strained. She felt bad for Ski Chaika. He was nice and funny and cute in a way that reminded Perkins a bit of her ex-husband, except Chaika was not a jerk, and alarms wailed across the airbase. "Get down!" Jesse was the first to shout, and they dropped to the damp grass. Before anyone could speak, the ground shook from a series of explosions at the airbase. Maser beams struck first, hitting parked aircraft, then a hypersonic railgun dart hit with a tremendous explosion. It sent a fountain of debris into the air and left a mushroom cloud boiling into the morning sky. "Look," Shauna said while pointing at the sky, her ears ringing. There were not merely one or two lights from Kristang ships jumping in to raid Paradise again. There were a dozen, more than a dozen lights. Many more than a dozen. Blindingly bright, silent explosions in orbit marked where ships were fighting. The Kristang were back, in force. "Oh, damn it," Jesse groaned and pounded the ground with a fist. "Not this shit again. Can't those two decide who owns this freaking planet?"